All right, everybody.
Welcome, everybody, to the show Life's a Banquet, the show that's edible, spreadable, and Zara.
Horrible.
Starring your hosts, me, Brenton Scott, and
me, Zara Tangora.
A show about ostriches, wine, and dough.
I'm drunk.
Always. Life's a banquet, life's a banquet, life's a banquet, banquet.
All right, one, two, three, go.
Welcome to Life's a Banquet, a podcast about the highs and lows of all things edible, spreadable, and horrible.
Starring your hosts, Brett and Scott, and
Zara Tangora.
Yeah, that's right. Welcome.
Hello.
Back to the show. It has been a couple weeks.
Oh, my God.
Well, I just would like to apologize, ever, all one of you.
I'm sorry, you.
Mom. To our two mothers, for our listeners. No, thank you very much. I was traveling in an exotic land.
Where were you?
I was in a country called Europe.
Oh my God, the country of Europe?
The country of Europe, yeah. It's a very large country filled with a lot of different cities.
Amazing.
I was in Spain. I was in the country of Spain, and it was fabulous. I was in the north. I flew to Madrid and ate. I gained a 4.8 kilos. For you Americans, I've converted into the metric system since spending 8 days in Spain, but that is about 8 pounds.
You don't look 1 kilo over.
Well,
200.
The belt buckles do not lie. Notch, there is a big difference between notch number two and number four.
Oh, no. So I'm going to Rome this upcoming week, and I'm a little bit worried about my waist band expanding.
You know what? It doesn't matter.
A moment on the lips, a lifetime on the hips.
Tell me about it. But you know, the good news is, you know, I came back full force, you know, running up and down stairs.
You ran back from Spain.
Yeah, I ran back from Spain. But
you're like, I'm going to walk to burn calories.
But let's talk about what the food was like.
Yes, please.
That's
the most important part.
Well, the north, so it was mostly in the north. Mm-hmm. But this is not an episode about Spain, but I will talk quickly that when we arrived in Madrid, it was so wonderful. And for those of you I went to high school in Madrid.
The entire time?
No, not the entire time. I went for one school year. And I was I was only in Madrid for 4 of the months because I was on the east coast of Spain first.
Oh, wow.
So then I was off of a spot called Avenida Oporto. And anyway, so this is years ago. It was 1993. So head, because I went back once in 1990, and then I tried to move to Barcelona during September 11th. So, and then that failed because of September 11th. I came back. I was like, oh my God.
They're like, your country needs you.
Yeah. My dad's like, you need to go to war. And I was like, you're right. And
what?
I'm ready to fight. So I think I went back and like got drunk for 2 months. I was like, oh, and there's not going to be a war. Shit. I should have moved to Spain. But anyway, so when I went back this time, that was the last time in 17 years. And part of me was like, oh my God, what would have been like if I did move back and September 11th didn't happen?
Yeah.
And all those questions and Spain was very different. Like in my head, it was this 1993 version, and it was not like that. You know,
right.
The economy's a lot better.
Nobody had a beeper.
Nobody had a beeper. There were cell phones everywhere. People were staring at their iPhones. But the one thing that I loved was, you know, when the tapas bars. And because it was there in high school, they didn't appreciate the same things that I do now.
Right.
When I was in high school, I used to go to this cider bar and drink a boot of giant boots of cider in Spain and get blackout drunk. So I tried to find that, but I couldn't remember. But I didn't know where it was.
I would drink out of a boot any age.
Any age.
It's
appropriate.
Old person, yeah.
But, you know, lots of sherry bars.
That's fabulous.
And, you know, you walk in, you pop your head in, you get, you know, you order a sherry, you order a beer, and it comes with a bowl of, like, smoked spiced olives.
Ugh.
Or not smoked olives, but, you know, with that Spanish pimento.
Yeah.
Maybe some chorizo, maybe you'll get a little piece of toast, maybe you'll get a little tomato bread, you know, something like that.
That's what America's missing. No snacks with the drinks.
No snacks with the drinks. And every glass of sherry, on the average, the places that I went to, the most expensive one was €2.
How much sherry do you think you drank in gallons?
Luckily, not that much. They are shorter pours, but
okay.
And, you know, that's the thing about Europe. They're very strict about the amount of alcohol that you get. So, and glasses of wine were like €1.20, €1.70. But everything has those measurements on the glasses.
Right. So, like 5 gallons?
I think they're, yeah. I would say 42 giant Slurpee cups from Long Island. Enough to get to the moon and back.
Big deli iced tea styrofoam.
Iced tea. Okay. Styrofoam cups.
Perfect.
Four of those.
Thank you. That's a very...
Does that make sense? Exactly. I'm glad
you're listening to our episodes, it seems.
Yes, I pay attention. I think our first day in Madrid, we went to 8 different bars.
Oh my
probably
God.
Probably only spent a total of 150 euros, but like this is 8 things. We had patatas bravas, the tortillas.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Sherry bars with like dusty sherry bottles just caked in dust and high up on shelves.
That's so fun.
You know, the food's just out, and I thought, you know, in America, you know why we can't have that? Because the health department shut you down. They'd be like, oh, you need to get rid of those sherry bottles. There's bacteria growing inside.
Yeah, there's fruit flies in here. It's like, yeah, no shit.
I didn't see a single damn fruit fly in Madrid.
One time, this is a fruit fly sidebar, but I was in Key West. And I ordered like a limoncello. I thought I was like being adult. I was with my boyfriend at the time. We went to a fancy dinner and I think we ordered like some kind of like, I think it was limoncello after dinner. And so they bring over a glass with limoncello on it. And my cup was completely filled with fruit flies. It wasn't like there was a fruit fly.
So what'd you do?
It was fruit flies. Even then I had the tact of being like, I wasn't a restaurant person yet, but I just like whispered to the waitress. I was like, I'm sorry. This is completely filled with flies.
Did they give you a new one?
Yeah. They were like, oh, sorry. We'll give you like, this is our like, you know, super fly filled limoncello. Yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. I'm never drinking limoncello again.
Well, how about, that's very funny.
I know. It's ridiculous.
Well, so what else? What else did you do while I was busy eating hummus?
I just like sat inside and just stared at the wall waiting for you to come back. Kind of like a dog when its master goes away. I just looked at the door. I'm like, he'll be back soon.
Exactly.
What did I do when you were away? Well, I booked a trip to Rome, as I mentioned earlier. Any listeners out there, if you have any Rome suggestions, please hit us up. Life's a Banquet podcast.
Life's a Banquet show at gmail.com. Mm-hmm. We'd love your emails. Thank you so much for all the emails and for continuing to listen to our rants and
raves.
Yes, rants and raves. I went to this butcher in Madrid and I bought some. I took the train. I wanted to make a little picnic.
Okay.
And when we got to the train, there was this old Spanish woman just staring me down, looking at me like, old women in Europe, you know how they're always so judgmental?
They're very judgmental.
They just stare at you.
Dressed all in black, mourning their hubbies.
Yes.
Yeah.
She was very judgmental. Anyway, but she ended up moving, thank God. But this butcher, his name was, I can't remember his name, but it was called Luis. Like, you know, Carnes Luis. Mm-hmm. And it was in this really cool market. The meats of Luis. And he let me taste every, like, different meat that I wanted to. And he was super friendly and... I had some of the most delicious jamon, the most incredible chorizo I've ever had in my life.
What made it so incredible? Dry chorizo?
Dry chorizo. It was so delicious and I can't describe it except that it was really good.
Yum. It's really smoky and meaty.
Well, that's the thing.
Wow. Thank you so much for that fake laugh. I feel better about myself.
Yeah. How about that? That's a genuine laugh. Mm-hmm. You know I'm laughing when I'm like...
And I'm like, stop doing that noise, you evil creature.
Anyway, that's some of the best part of life. If you have an opportunity to travel, and even if you're out there, you're listening, you're like, oh, I can't travel to the, you know, country of Europe, the continent of Spain.
You know
what?
You know me. I'm real cheap, and we shared an Airbnb, and it was not expensive to go out to eat. And I think the most expensive thing... Choleta. They have this like giant ribeye steak everywhere in the north because we were in San Sebastian and every restaurant had their big grilled steak with potatoes and roasted piquillo peppers.
Any sauces with the steak?
No, Spain doesn't like sauces. They don't like condiments. They don't like soap.
They have romesco sauce.
They do have they do have some things.
What about aioli?
They do have aioli.
Yeah.
But it's not put
that's
on...
it.
Like, you wouldn't put aioli in a sandwich. That would be like, why would you do that?
Really?
Yeah, it's strange.
Where do you put it? On a French fry?
On bravas.
Bravas?
Yeah.
Papas bravas? Patatas bravas?
Patatas bravas.
Patatas bravas.
We did have a really, one of those black rice dishes, kind of like a pie, but it was with mussels
that
and squid.
That gets aioli, right?
That gets a big dollop of aioli. Yeah. You mix it around. Oh, it's so delicious.
That's the most delicious.
I know it sounds silly, but like obviously we're cooks, and when I travel, it's so exciting to go to a country that takes food so seriously.
Absolutely.
And every bar has a different, you know, it's like Spain and Rome, you know, right? they all have their things. Like, you're going to go to every restaurant, and every restaurant has to have Spanish tortilla, you know, in Rome. Everywhere has to have a cacio pepe.
Yeah.
And then you're like, that's so weird that all, like,
yeah,
I don't know, 10,000 restaurants in a particular city mm-hmm. would all have to have the same menu.
I know, it's
but
really
they all
crazy.
Do it in their own unique way, and some suck, some are great. Just
right.
Like,
well, it's like pride in the fact that like it's different than what we do here. Is we're first of all, there's a much more kind of like diverse restaurant culture in New York City, of course. But you know, I think there, like when you go away to like you know cities like Madrid, Rome, Barcelona, whatever. Paris, you know, the standards that are in every kind of restaurant, it's like almost like a competition. Oh, our
yeah.
onion soup is
exactly
you know, is more fabulous than the one down in, you know, the other quarter. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing about traveling. And I was going to just say about traveling that it's one of the things that makes living in this trash fire of a world like worth it. And if you can't afford to actually travel to Europe, like there's certainly plenty of things that you can do to travel locally, find out a different weird city, like near your city, or a strange thing that you didn't know was in like the town next to you, you know,
just somewhere new. And it was exciting. Yeah. It was exactly what the doctor ordered.
Yeah.
And by doctor, I mean, my psychiatrist, so I can get off the medication.
I just picture you having a doctor kind of yeah. like Hunter S. Thompson.
The doctor's like,
doctor.
As you wean yourself off these psychotropics, you're going to have to go to Spain and have a... Yeah, so I followed his orders, and I'm happy.
He's like, you're going to need to eat 10 pounds of calamari sandwich. What are those things called?
Bocadillo de calamari.
Bocadillo de calamari?
Yeah, so bocadillo, and it's just it's a baguette with yeah. fried calamari.
Delicious?
Nope. I love it. It's
would
good.
You,
I mean,
did you wish there was aioli on it?
I did. Yeah. I was like, this would be really good maybe with maybe as a thinly sliced tomato yeah. or maybe like some aioli, some scallions. I was like, well, how could I do it? I was like, well, I could do some mustard. And I was like, maybe a little, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, you want
like, to. What if I made it Vietnamese style? That would be good too. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and they're like, get the fuck out of here. Like, this
no.
is not how it, no.
Oh, Jesus, okay, it is. I had one thing and I'll stop talking about it. I asked this girl and I forgot that the word for sherry is Jerez.
Oh, wow.
Jerez.
Okay.
And I went and I was like, oh, hola. I was like, favor. I was like, me gustaría dos copas de sherry. And she's like, sherry? No tenemos sherry. And she was so mean to me. And she's like,
oh my God.
No tenemos sherry. I was like, no tienes de like oloroso or manzanillo, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, no, we don't have that. And I'm like, and then she said it in English. I was like,
oh
okay,
God.
Well, if you knew that she was so mean to me.
And did you leave?
She gave us a free bowl of olives and it was delicious.
Amazing. I wonder if she's... Did you guys become friends in the end?
No. We hated each other. We saw... got a huge cat fight in the back.
Stared each other down the whole entire way.
See these scratches on my back? I know, yeah. Should have seen her. I had a bite of her ear. It was delicious.
So what have I been doing? Nothing really. I mean, I've been going to the farmer's market a lot. I'm trying to think of what I've made.
It's that weird end of the season, right?
Like, I think it's an amazing end to the season. I love...
Well, it's been very warm.
September and October... is my favorite time at the farmer's market.
There were still peaches and plums.
I know, that's very
strange.
And
quinces.
And plums.
Yeah.
Have you missed talking with your friends about plums all this time?
No, because I'm moved on to quinces and pawpaws. Oh. So
excuse
there.
Excuse all of us.
Yeah.
Guys, it's no longer a plum cast.
It's a
prune cast.
It's a quince cast. Starring your host, Quince.
Yeah. Quince Scott and Quince Tangora. Anyway, I'm loving the farmer's market. I saw the most big, beautiful cabbage of my life yesterday as I walked by. And then
$4.
I called Breton and I was like, I couldn't buy it because I'm going away, so I would have nothing to do with it. But I thought about buying it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, how
big,
could I
giant
eat this?
Savoy, those ruffled...
15-pound cabbage, probably? No,
I don't know, it was humongous.
10-pound? It's probably 10-pound cabbage.
It was probably 5 pounds. But
I was like, how could I eat this 300-pound cabbage in 2 days before I leave to Rome? And then I was like, I will be so gassy on the plane if I try to eat...
The cabbage soup diet.
Cabbage
soup diet. That's the perfect thing. You lose 10 pounds before you go to Rome, and then you'll come out even.
That's true. Although, I would be like, do you ever hear that story of the person who, like, farted on the plane so badly they had to, like, land the plane early?
Yeah.
They probably tried to eat a 10-pound cabbage before they left.
Okay, hold on. Before I go, this beautiful Savoy cabbage, you would, oh my God, how could you pass it up? I immediately went, I bought the cabbage yesterday before, and I'm making stuffed cabbage leaves, of course.
Perfect. What are you going to do with the center of the cabbage?
Well, I had thought about it, and I'm going to... I'm going to shred it and put it in the mixture.
Yeah. That's what my mom used to do with the sauce. She used to put she still does, my grandma too. She used to put the middle of the cabbage chopped up and braised in the sauce.
Maybe I'll do that instead. I kind of like that better.
Yeah. I also just fucking love roasted cabbage. like every cabbage roasted is, cabbage.
Roasted cabbages.
For anyone out there who thinks they don't like cabbage for some reason, you don't know from cabbage.
I'll tell you what. You do a nice simple roast cabbage and throw some sausage in there and some put some clarified butter in it.
Yeah. The best.
And like sprinkle some toasted caraway seeds or something like that onto anything.
I love, I think cabbage actually, to be honest with you.
It's a cabbage cast.
It's a cabbage. Yeah, welcome okay. to the cabbage cast. I think cabbage could possibly be in my top three favorite vegetables of all time. Think about it for just a minute. Sauerkraut, coleslaw,
kimchi. Wow.
That's it.
I'm still waiting.
Those things are
what else?
No, but roasted cabbage is great. When at Brucey, for anyone who doesn't know, from every single time we do this podcast, I talk about I'm like the person who scored a touchdown one time in high school and was like, that one time at that game that was I was so good at, remember?
Oh, you were homecoming queen. Let's talk back. You rode around in a Corvette. It was wonderful.
No, but at Brucey, we used to do a roasted cabbage wedge as like a wedge salad. It was delicious. Instead of an iceberg wedge, we do a roasted cabbage wedge.
That does sound delicious.
It was really good. It was really, really good.
I tried, you know, I went on that keto diet a couple years ago for a month.
Okay.
And cabbage was, you know, high up on the list because it's really, it's fibrous. It has virtually no carbohydrates. And if you cover it in butter, you know, if you do the keto method, which is covering every, it's like the modern, what's that guy's name?
Atkins.
Atkins diet.
Totally perfect.
It's like an Atkins diet. Like have cabbage with 1 pound of bacon, a half a stick of butter, two bulletproof coffees, voila. And I did. You do lose weight. But then I got
But then you die of a heart attack immediately.
Died of a heart attack. And then I got real hungry for other flavors after the month that I gained more weight.
Oh, wow.
Because I was back.
Because you were like, I need bread.
Yep.
Yeah. But like when I have bread, I now need like a pound of butter on it.
Yeah, that's the
problem. I'm so used to butter. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I guess when you eat carbs, you're not supposed to eat fat and carbs together.
That's the thing.
Not be, you know, if you're minding your,
you know, that's the whole thing too. I was just like, when I'm traveling, I was like,
of course.
At one point we had two steaks in one day, one for lunch, one for dinner. I said, I don't care. I'm probably not going to have I don't make steaks that often at home.
I thought you should have had three steaks if you could.
Yeah,
I tried.
I couldn't. Just simply couldn't squeeze it. It was like
you're just like someone's like. I'm picturing Preston like putting steak in your mouth and pressing his foot down on it, like trying to like squish it down. Like,
can you swallow? No. Keep going.
You know, like that scene in the end of Fargo with like the wood chipper, and he's like trying to just shove his foot. Steve Buscemi's foot into the wood chipper, and he's like trying to push it down with a log.
That's right.
That's what I'm picturing, but with your stomach and steak.
My goodness. Well, I came, you know, first thing I did when I got back home was, I mean, you know, that pan con tomate, pan con tomate, if you're in Catalan. And it was so fun to see people, you know, actually make it.
Yeah.
Because I learned from an old Madrid grandmother, and she used to grate the tomatoes.
You said that, yeah.
But when I was at this restaurant in Barcelona, the woman, she was crazy. It was like a diner. But it was like a Catalan diner. It was really good food. That's where I had that black rice. And they, you know, they slice open the bread and they grill the bread. And then she like grabs a tomato.
Yeah.
And like smashes the tomato with her bare hands, squeezes it open. Like it's a, you know, pulsating heart. And
that's
then like
amazing.
Rubbed it onto the bread.
Ugh.
And so it made the bread taste like, it almost had like an English muffin texture.
Oh, maron.
So it's like, you know, olive oil. It had that like.
It's the best.
Oh.
But you said no garlic in Barcelona.
I don't know. I saw some people doing it, but I heard that traditionally it's not. But I like to put it on mine.
Yeah.
This morning I made some. I didn't give it to Preston because he didn't want some. So
why not?
He just didn't want his breath to smell like garlic.
Oh, interesting.
Because one time when I first met him, I yelled at him and I was like, oh, your breath is so garlicky. And now I've scarred his enjoyment.
Oh, you scarred him for life. Yeah.
I've ruined it.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to therapy and anyway.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the same. No, not really.
Okay, but you're the same drug therapist. Yeah, yeah. He's like, just take two of just these take and three of these and everything's going to be perfect forever.
One in the morning, one in the afternoon, and Ambien at night and block out all memories.
That's funny. I told you this story before, but the listeners might like to hear it. It's a travel story. And then we can get into our topic.
Mm,
but the first time that I ever traveled abroad, my friend, who will remain unnamed, you know who you are if you're listening, gave me what... I had asked for was a Xanax.
A Xanax.
I was nervous traveling.
Yes.
She gave me what she said was a Xanax, but what was actually an ecstasy pill.
Mm.
And so somewhere, and it was also the 4th of July, and I took this, and then I started
flying out of here.
Flying
in New York.
Out of JFK
New York.
At like 9 p.m. So we're flying above the fireworks, and I'm like, I'm rolling. Like, I had taken ecstasy before, so I knew what it felt like, and I was rolling. And then somebody fucking died on the plane also.
And you didn't imagine it?
They were 100% dead. I did not imagine it.
And they...
It was fucking crazy. They died, and I was sitting like...
Who are they sitting next to, and what do they do with the body?
The body... I was in the back of the... I was one row in front of the dead body.
So they just left it there?
No. No, it was a tent. I mean, I knew that they died, too, because they didn't stop the... Like, well, I mean, they covered the person up. They said there was an emergency. I saw the sick passenger being attended to. I was freaking out for several reasons. I used to be much more afraid of flying.
Well, yeah, naturally.
And afraid of dying. And dying while flying. And then here's someone dying while flying. And
fly die.
They covered them up and like they didn't stop early. Like, you know, if it could have been.
Yeah, what are they going to do?
Yeah. They didn't like, oh, we'll stop in London or something or turn around. So.
Wow. How about that? Well, just horrible. Goes to show, make sure you Google the back of your pill first. Nowadays.
Exactly. Don't take it if it's from X, whatever. I was going to say my friend's name, but that would be horrible. Don't take it if it's from blah, 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 who lives at Diggity Doop Street.
If it's Marissa Sweetolini, do not take her. She does not have real Xanax. Don't trust her. I don't recommend it. Marissa, if you're listening, screw it.
Another time when I was flying, this is right before I was in a very horrible accident when I was younger. And on my way out before the accident happened, I was flying to San Francisco. And this is a time when I actually did take Xanax. I was so afraid of flying. I took three Xanax and I drank a bunch. I was like 21 years old. And like, I just remember passing out in my coat, head first. I was in a middle seat. All I remember is waking up and being like, I need a Bloody Mary. And I was just like, Bloody Mary, like a Bloody Mary monster, just like running around the aisles, like Bloody Mary. And they're like, ma'am, get back to your seat immediately. And I was like, okay.
Not until I have a Mr. and Mrs. Cheese. Plain Bloody Mary.
Not without my Sacramento tomato juice. And
isn't that weird
vodka.
On planes? Everybody has to get tomato juice. You have, okay. Here's required plane food or plane drinks.
Yeah.
A ginger ale. Everybody suddenly drinks ginger ale, and everybody drinks tomato juice.
No one ever, after the year 1970, I think, ever drank tomato juice just plain by itself, ever, unless they're on a plane.
Unless you're on a plane.
They're like, oh, yes, tomato juice for me. Tomato juice used to be an appetizer in the 1960s. Interesting that we say that.
Well, you know what? This is so funny. I'm holding in my hand here. Wrong hand.
Oh, that.
Pardon me. Don't look at the hands, are you creep? Why am I holding that in my hand during a podcast? You may wonder.
Brenton's holding one hand is on the microphone. Just the other kidding. Hand is holding.
I'm looking
his penis.
At a cookbook, and actually, the title of this book is "The Good Cook." It's a series of cookbooks, and this one, what does that say, Zara?
Variety Meats.
Variety.
That's an
meats.
Awesome cookbook. Did you get that at the place in Long Island?
Yes,
the Holiday House.
And look at this. This one. It's so funny because. The consulting chef for this book was Richard Olney.
Okay.
Who was that famous? He wrote like the French Menu cookbook.
Never heard of him.
Alice Waters says that when she opened Chez Panisse, the restaurant was based off of that.
Oh, really?
That one of the cookbooks, like the French Menu cookbook, I think it was.
Oh my God.
Written by Richard Olney, who was a fabulous homosexual living in France.
Fun.
During the 60s when MFK Fisher was there. Julia Child was there. In France. Yeah.
So our topic today, you guys, is the 1960s. And Brenton is taking the angle of French food.
Yeah, sharp angle.
What?
Nice angle.
What do you mean? Was that too far of a jump?
No.
We're doing the 1960s anyway. Bye.
Listen, it's a big topic and you had to pick something, right?
Yeah.
Well, I have a really good story, but I want to hear what's going on. We're doing some low stuff, right?
We're doing highs and lows. Should we do the low first or the high first?
Wait, are we low?
Want to start with the low? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. It's up
that's
to you.
Good. No, end on a high note. I think you're right.
Yeah, I think so.
I think we should end on a high note. Okay, so we're doing the 1960s today. We were like, this is kind of a cool topic, and we're trying this new format here on LAB. Of you know, it is about the highs and lows of everything edible, spreadable, and pourable. And so each week, for now on, it could change next week. No one can tell us what to do.
You know what, Madonna?
Except for our mommies.
Yeah. Except for our moms. Listen, Madonna changed her look every.
Oh yeah, that's
time
true.
For a new look.
Exactly, and
we're
this
having
is,
a new look.
Yeah, and or Cher, Lady Gaga.
Yeah, you know what? Guess what? It's 2018. and we've only and 2018 still, actually we start and we started the podcast in 2018, so therefore
exactly, and this is episode 18. Okay, so anyway, we're gonna try to do each week one person will do a high and one person will do a low story on the same topic, which I think is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's pretty radical. So anyway, my low topic for the 1960s today is about the Vietnam War.
So big
part of the 60s. The war actually started in the year 1954, although it had really been going on, like tensions and things have been building, of course, surrounding communism for some time. And as we all know, or maybe some people don't know, essentially the Vietnam War started as kind of a reaction to the fear that communism would spread throughout Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of going to talk about like two different things about food during the Vietnam War. So just a couple of Vietnam War facts. Dwight D. Eisenhower was president when it actually began in 1954. May 7, 1954, the Viet Minh forces won the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and ended the French involvement in Indochina. So after that happened, there was the Geneva Conference, and the French and the Viet Minh negotiated a ceasefire agreement. So that's kind of how everything is panning out. Then Ho Chi Minh takes control of the North, and the French educated Emperor Bao Dai takes control of the South. Eisenhower was president when it began, as I said, and when it ended in 1973. So when it ended in 1973, Gerald Ford was president. Just a couple of fun facts here. Really fun, because mm-hmm. everyone knows how fun the Vietnam War was. Yeah. That's what it's known for. It was America's most fun war.
Yeah.
At the end of the war, by the time it ended, an estimated 2 million Vietnamese people were killed, and 3 million were wounded, and another 12 million became refugees.
Ouch.
Really horrible.
I went to the war museum in...
You've been to Vietnam.
Yeah.
And where is it? And it's Ho Chi Minh City?
Yeah, Ho Chi Minh City is Saigon, whatever you want to, you know, the old
right,
Saigon.
Right, right.
But it's interesting because, you know, their perspective of, I mean, is very anti-American. It's like,
oh,
look
really?
At this horrible country and what they did to us.
Yeah.
So the whole museum is really like, wow, like then American soldiers did this, these horrible beasts and humans, which is true.
Yeah,
it, when absolutely. You see it, you're like, wow, they.
Absolutely. And also, you know, American soldiers at the time had horrible things done to them. It was a horrible thing. It was young kids and just
it was
being,
a horrible time.
Everyone was just. Brutalized, and you know, the people who were sending the orders didn't get affected, obviously, as
yeah, exactly.
things tend to happen. Just send your minions over to a jungle to ruin everyone's
yes,
lives.
I've decided this. Our cabinet has decided this yeah. will happen.
Really, really, really bad. Oh, and obviously, really disgusting, horrible things happened. So about 58,200 people, American people, soldiers, were killed. In Vietnam. And the U.S. between the years of 1965 and 1973, the nation spent over $120 billion on the Vietnam War.
$120 yeah. billions of dollars. Not doll hairs, but
dollars.
Actual dollars.
Real dollars. Dollars make sense. So during that the Vietnam
true.
War, one of the really awful kind of things they used as chemical warfare was called Agent Orange.
Agent Orange, yep.
Which was made of a horrible, 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 horrible chemical called dioxin.
Dioxin.
And basically the U.S. was using this chemical warfare. The reason I'm talking about it as in the food podcast is because it was meant mostly to like poison all of the crops. And all the food.
Oh, okay,
so they're dusting
right.
it on everything.
So that, yeah, kill the food source.
Exactly.
Stop the war. People can't eat.
Exactly. Now, bear in mind that people in Vietnam prior to the war are already very poor and living, you know, literally dirt poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like this is just like a extremely rich country. I mean, a lot of these places in the jungle where people are living, they're, you know, living on rice paddies. They're eating rice. They're
yeah,
cooking
living
on,
off the land.
You know, they're living in shacks. So it's not, you know. So... it's killing all of their crops. And then when they eat anything, then it's causing cancer
mm-hmm.
in them. And the same goes for the American soldiers too. So American soldiers are also occasionally, you know, I mean, they're living and they're dusting the fields with Agent Orange, and then they're going to go down to the fields and they might drink from a stream or they might
of course,
catch a
yeah.
fish or like eat some rice.
I mean, anything.
Right. So
all goes in the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
Groundwater
so,
and
Yeah. During the Vietnam War, there was a operation called a code name Operation Ranch Hand, where they sprayed more than 20 million gallons of various herbicides over Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos between 1961 and 1971. And that wasn't just Agent Orange. They also had like Agent Pink, Agent Blue, but Agent Orange was the most popular one that they used. They would use aircrafts, and they would also just like spray it out of trucks and stuff. And so it was really, really, really bad for absolutely everyone. So a couple of our favorite people were responsible for manufacturing Agent Orange. Ever heard of a little company called Monsanto? Yeah.
Oh, I like that company.
Not only do they produce a bunch of genetically modified seeds and, you know, pump our supermarkets full of watery, nutritionless vegetables, but they also were responsible for manufacturing Agent Orange, which is super awesome. Also, so did Dow Chemical. You're also on blast, which is funny because I was just rewatching Mad Men and there was a huge thing about how, about Dow Chemical and producing Agent Orange. Yeah. The Nation reported that some 400,000 people were killed or maimed as a result of exposure to herbicides like Agent Orange. And in 1979, after the war was over, a class action lawsuit on behalf of 2.4 million veterans was filed against the United States of America and the chemical producers that made Agent Orange. And they ended up at a $180 million settlement, which sounds like a lot, but it's not for 2.4 million people.
Yeah,
no. All those soldiers, 2.4 million soldiers. I can't even believe there was 2.4 million veterans that were
affected.
That's actually a crazy, mind-blowing number. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah,
before.
Try to imagine 2.4. I can't even imagine 40 people.
I know. I mean, and we think of this like, I don't know. I just can't imagine our friends and like colleagues
people
going over there. So. That was just kind of like a little mini snippet of something I wanted to mention just because it was food related. Obviously, this is an extreme low. And then I wanted to...
as low as it gets.
It's as low as it gets. It's like poisoning people's food. It's so fucked up.
It's from the inside. It's the devil.
You're just eating poison. You're like, here's like, you know...
You're going to get... And you're not just going to die. You're going to get really sick.
And like women and children... And I actually, you know, I always find like the whole women and children and men.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody.
Grown, innocent men,
innocent
women,
people
children.
That are just living their lives.
Yeah, they're just like, hey, I'm just trying to like get by every day. Like, oh, cool. I already had a hard time. Thanks for now poisoning my rice paddy. Awesome. That's great. America. Yeah, America, the greatest country in the world. Okay. So another thing that was, you know, the big food thing, during Vietnam that I wanted to mention was how soldiers typically had to eat. Obviously they didn't get to eat like amazing food while you're over.
Yeah. They weren't having banh mi's
and
spring rolls.
They were pretty, from my research, some articles I read said that, you know, yeah, we'd like go into a city and we'd, you know, try to eat the local food, but mostly people were like just afraid of it and they'd try to find places that like would serve hamburgers and stuff, or like, you know, it would be too dangerous to go into cities, or when they could, people might like poison them. So soldiers primarily, you know, sustained on the rations that were provided to them. And then when they were in combat, like not at base camp, they had something called C rations or Charlie rations. And these were like meant to only be eaten for like 2 to 3 days tops, because it's really like bad stuff and everything was in a can. So some things they would have would be like ham and lima beans and like a can of cheese plastic. One of the ingredients, if you read these old 1960s cans, is cheese plastic. That's what it says on the cheese
and
crackers.
Cheese made with plastic?
Basically. It was like Cheese Whiz, like cheese plastic. And they would get things like cigarettes in there. So a sea ration would be like a can of meat, cheese and crackers, like some cookies.
Cheese and crackers.
Yeah, like a cola, like some kind of, it was really bad. And then they'd have like toothpaste, cigarettes. And then they'd have Tabasco sauce.
Yes.
And so Tabasco... actually came
I need
up.
I need a little pizzazz in my food, my canned lima beans over here.
Yeah, they're like, well, I want to zhuzh it up. So Tabasco actually came up with an entire cookbook called the Charlie Rations Cookbook. All right, so yeah, the Charlie Ration Cookbook, you know, it was quoted, some of the end part is, G.I. Joe has gone gourmet. These recipes were created for the fighting man in the field. Bon appetit. And it's like animated and has all these pictures of soldiers, you know, huddled around a campfire cooking, and they give you a list of suggestions of things you can add. they say the following ingredients may be found in the battle theater by begging, borrowing, or bartering when available. These items have been incorporated with the sea rations to bring out their hidden secrets, whatever they may be.
Oh my gosh, I'm looking at this recipe, breast of chicken under bullets.
Yeah, they're crazy.
I don't...
Can you read it, like what it says? What to do? Do you put it under the bullets? Oh, wait, let's see. Breast of chicken under a glass was never intended for areas where the glass and shrapnel fly. This dish can be prepared in quick time using only the basic sea ration. Heat the bone chicken in a meat can. Melt the cheese. Oh, by the way, I read that they used to use like C4, their C4 canisters to like heat their sea rations.
Really?
Yeah. And they used to fish with grenades. They used to throw grenades into the river and like blow up a river and then all the fish would die and that's how they would fish.
Oh, wow.
Heat the can of bone chicken in a meat can. Melt the cheese bread. That's what I was talking about, cheese plastic. If butter, oil, or fat is available, add 2 spoons. Season with salt and pepper and, of course, Tabasco. Yeah.
And try this, Tabasco.
And put some Tabasco. Cut a loaf of white bread in half, trimmed as so desired. Place a mound of chicken over each white bread and cover each with hot melted cheese sauce. This should stick to your ribs.
Actually, it stays on your ribs and you can never get rid of it.
Yeah, it's like, and it's full of Agent Orange.
This plastic will latch itself onto your ribs.
I wonder why it says under bullets. It makes it sound like you would like cook it under the... I guess it's just when bullets are coming at you and you're like almost going to die. You're like, you know what? I'm really hungry for a cheesy melt.
Yeah, the cookbook writer's like, oh, here. They're all sitting around office. We're like, I got a good one. So wait, there's soldiers. They're all depressed. They're probably like worried if they're going to die every day. I have a good one. Let's lighten it up with a little humor.
Trapped in a prison camp? No big deal. Make this goulash. Yeah.
Prison camp. Yeah, prison camp goulash.
You just imagine it.
Yeah. Wait, it's actually happening. Okay. Yeah, so this is a...
So yeah, foxhole dinner for two, soup du jour, which is a can of ham and lima beans, which apparently was the worst one sea ration to get. They're like, if you got the ham and lima beans, you just like wouldn't eat it. I saw a guy on YouTube today who was opening up. He found a thing of sea rations from the 60s and he opened it live on YouTube. It's actually really interesting to watch. And he's like, the smell was so bad from it that he was like vomiting.
I mean, I could imagine.
Yeah. Tin can, casserole, pork, mandarin. Oh man. But anyway, a lot of times I was reading that the soldiers would say like, you know, they gave you all these suggestions for this book and they're like, oh, well, just catch a fish. And then, you know, you pour like the turkey soup over it. And they're like, we can't catch a fish. And if we did, it would be full of Agent Orange. So yeah, it wasn't very practical. It was just, I guess, more like to offer people a little pick me up, you know,
perhaps maybe it was just all humor, but
I think, I mean,
that's how seems... I wonder if it was paid for by the Tabasco Association of, as if there is one.
The Tabasco, so Big Tabasco?
Big Tabasco of United States, because isn't Tabasco from Mexico?
That's interesting. Yes, I think
I watched a documentary
about
Tabasco, how it was, you know, it's barrel aged for 2 or 3 years or something.
Well, maybe that was the big joke. Mexico is just like, here's a cookbook, America, about what to make when you're in the Vietnam War. Like, try this combat zone burgoo.
A burgoo.
What's a burgoo? Like,
it's a burger and a goo.
A gooey burger?
A gooey burger.
A burger soup? It's like chili.
Yeah.
Anyway, patrol chicken soup is another one. And then at the very end, beefsteak and crew. And like...
beefsteak en crew, because that's exactly what you're thinking.
Like, the en crew, I guess. So en crew is like in pastry, right?
Exactly.
And I guess the crew in this situation is white bread, it says.
So you take some white bread. You know what? What a simple way to do it.
Exactly. Ceasefire casserole. Yeah. Oh my god.
Ceasefire casserole. This is hopefully it was
every recipe
funny,
has like, Tabasco in it. Anyway, I thought boss. That was funny. And a low. It must have been really, really hard to be over there. I really just when I think about the Vietnam War, I think of all these like teenagers who just like graduate high school and they're like, cool, now I'm in Vietnam.
I haven't watched the Ken Burns Vietnam documentary.
I watched
yet.
It with my dad.
It's many, many
it's
hours,
incredible.
Right? It's like 12 hours to 15 hours or something.
It's incredible.
I need to watch that. And but when I was at the museum and you look at the pictures, and I mean, that can only do so much just by looking at a picture. But my dad was in the Army Reserves.
Okay.
Because he was in medical school, so he didn't actually get drafted.
Oh, wow.
Luckily, he was actually helping out with, at the base camps before they would head out.
Got it.
He was volunteering doing medical work.
Okay.
That was actually how he avoided it.
In the States. Interesting.
Because had he been graduated as a doctor, they probably would have sent him over there because they would have needed medical.
And then you wouldn't have been born.
And I wouldn't have been born, and you wouldn't be listening to my damn voice.
Yeah. My dad told me that he avoided getting drafted because, okay, so he goes, he had like a bad number. You know how they used to do it? The draft was based on like numbers.
Mm-hmm.
If you had like a high number, you would be okay, and a low number, maybe, pardon my ignorance, but maybe it's backwards. But anyway, it was a number system. So my dad had like a bad number. So it was almost certain that he was going to get drafted.
Yeah.
So they call his number and he has to go in for like a check. And he's like, I stayed up all night the night before and I did acid and I did all these drugs. Yeah. He's like, I smoked weed. I got wasted. I smoked like a million cigarettes just so I had to be as like terrible, like, you know, downtrodden as possible. I look like a scumbag.
A crazy person.
Exactly. So he had his friend who was like a drug dealer. I think my dad was even selling acid at the time. Yeah, so
he wasn't.
He got really messed up. Right. So he goes in the next day. He's like, I'm clearing every station. He's like, everyone's like, yep, you look fine. You look fine. You look fine. And so he gets to the last station. It's like the physical examination or something.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had very bad scoliosis. He said he popped out his back, like twisted spine as much as he possibly could and started walking over with like this weird limpy limp. And he gets over and they're like, yep, you're not going. And he's like, no, really, I can do it. I can do it. I really want to. And they're like, sorry, you're not going. You're not going to fight anywhere. Like, get out of here. And they shoot him out. And he never went to the war. And he never had to go to war. And he would have definitely died. My dad was not a fighter.
Maybe he would have been like the cook. He would have been like, all right, let's bring this cookbook to life.
Maybe.
Like, hold on, kids. I see a good one. Burgoot.
Burgoot.
Oh, wait, hold Somebody on. Somebody warm up the bullets.
Burgoot pie.
All right. Now, the bullets are actually going to be mushrooms, right? So you kind of, that's where he got it from.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my story. That's the low of the 1960s food scene.
Now, here's the thing, because when I looked at the 60s, Zara and I are kind of obsessed with the 60s.
We are. We're kind of born in the wrong decade, it seems.
We're in the wrong decade. There's something you think, you know, when you think of the 1960s, and I think in the food sense, you know, everything that was like when post-World War II and everything was really starting to, you know, pop and things were exciting and exoticism was everywhere.
Ooh, quiche.
Like, yeah, like quiche and phyllo pastry and baklava.
Yeah.
Hummus.
Whoa.
Okay. So, you know, some of those things that you think of the 60s that were popular were something like Lipton onion soup dip.
Still great.
French onion dip, the same things, you know, everything was encased in gelatin.
Because
why
gelatin.
Wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And I had a whole story about Jell-O, but that's a different topic.
Mm-hmm.
Meatballs and grape jelly. Everybody was like, Swedish meatballs. But in America, we're like, well, just take some packaged meat and, you know, put a...
My grandma used to make that. She made her meatballs with something called sauce Arturo, which doesn't really exist anymore. But it's basically like weird mushroom tomato sauce. And then she'd put in a can of that, this mushroom tomato sauce Arturo, and a can of cranberry sauce.
That is so crazy. Chicken a la king, you know, like... Clams Casino, it's stuffed celery and cherry tomatoes, all those fun stuff. That if you make it good, you know, pigs in a blanket were popular then.
Yes, hors d'oeuvres galore.
And so, you know, there is this, I started thinking about like where I would want to take this story, and it made me think of certain French food.
Okay.
Right, that's really in America, you know, we're all, who isn't obsessed with Julia Child? How can you not?
Yeah, yeah.
I am more of like a Fanny Crowder kind of a person. But...
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you something. French food. Why do you think French food became so popular in the 1960s? And there's a couple, you could think of a couple of reasons
why. That's a really good question. You know what? I mean, why don't you just tell me?
Well, yeah.
My brain hurts.
Well,
I'm tired.
I know everything because I was alive in the 60s. Just kidding. I have no idea.
You're a vampire.
But based on certain readings, and I have deduced the answer. And
Tell me.
So there was a woman. Now, this woman just died last year. She was one of the most famous cookbook publishers of our modern time, and her name was, you might know who she is, Judith Jones.
Okay.
Now, Judith Jones, bless her heart, died last year. She was old. She lived in the East Coast, and she became at one point the publisher for Knopf Publishing.
Okay.
Now, guess who Knopf.
Knopf. That is a hard, that's a
tongue
twister.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Knopf.
Knopf.
So, Knopf published the 1961 or 62? The Mastering the Art of French Cooking.
Of course.
Now, listen, of course, everybody knows about that cookbook.
Magnum Opus.
And the cool, what I thought, even kind of like a mini low within that story, was that her manuscript was rejected first because Julia Child was still living in France, I believe.
Oh.
And so, you know, she, with her cookbook writer, who, by the way, I think probably wrote a lot of it, Simone Beck, if you're really into those little cookbook worlds. Anyway, they had tried to publish the cookbook, and it wasn't getting published.
Right.
And Judith Jones, okay, so Judith Jones, I'm basically having a little bit of a twist of a story. Is that she was this, she was a cook, and she would throw dinner parties, and she left home at an early age. I mean, she was born in 1924 from Vermont, and that's where she died also. But she was very well traveled and went and met her husband, who was also a cook, and they decided to, you know, they wrote cookbooks together. Of course, you know, lifelong process.
Right.
So that was really interesting. Now, just because Julia Child had this program, and it was like right timing for her. And this is where the story gets real juicy, folks.
Okay,
all right, really? All right, get that popcorn. All right, drizzle that extra butter. That's right. Just like we told you, she put some Parmesan on that popcorn. It's delicious. Don't have white cheddar powder? No problem.
Ooh,
white cheddar powder. Okay. So now here's a little interesting thing that I thought about the 60s.
Go ahead.
You know, America, and I'm speaking from an American perspective, but there was something that changed within the government, and it had to do with the president. Mm-hmm. And there was a president called, you might have heard of him, JFK?
I have heard of him, yes.
John F. Kennedy.
He was named after the airport, right?
Yep, he was named after the airport.
Perfect.
Exactly.
Perfect.
First, there was the airport, then
the man. Yeah, his parents loved
the
airport.
So, John F. Kennedy, and of course his most glamorous wife,
so glamorous,
Miss Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. And so there was a thing; they were role models for many people in this country because, and they loved French food. And specifically, Jacqueline Kennedy.
Interesting.
Yeah. So now this is what happened. So like in the late '50s, and I didn't know this, but before that, the food in the White House, I guess, was not necessarily that important. And it was sort of known for having presidents were just not known for having really good chefs or food.
Interesting.
Now, if anybody has any other information besides this, what I came across.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't matter. This is the story that we're
this
going
This is the
along
truth.
With.
This is history.
And Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis decided to hire a French chef.
Wow.
Yeah, so this particular French chef, his name was René Verdon.
Okay.
And he was a French-born chef. And he actually, the reason that he got the job, I don't know the whole story, but apparently he was working at the Carlyle Hotel.
Oh, how fancy.
Carlyle Hotel, and I think...
And brings it all back to our Bellamans.
Yes. So Jacqueline Kennedy was looking for a French chef, found a fancy, you know, Upper East Side French chef.
Okay.
He elevated the food cuisine. And so the Kennedys were like, we love French food.
Oh, my
and
God.
So,
and everybody loved the Kennedys.
And everybody loved the Kennedys. And so Julia Child's right there. But like, look, I've been making French food. And she was so...
Oh,
just,
my God.
I think it was perhaps maybe a bit serendipitous and also just maybe a stroke of luck. Maybe not. Right place, right time, right?
Yeah.
And she ended up... So people instantly attached themselves to anything French. You know,
wow.
We all became Francophiles because of the Kennedys, because of a sophisticated, wonderful president with a well-mannered... an educated wife.
Yeah, and good
and
taste.
And a wonderful woman who volunteered. I mean, just excellent, wonderful people to look up to. Role models that had manners.
Imagine that.
Yeah. And
yeah.
Look what happened to him. He got killed. So listen, so this is the whole thing. So René Verdon, this is a really funny story, and I love this, is that he was known for having this fabulous dinner where they shipped all their guests that were, not shipped them. They sent them on yachts down the Potomac River.
Oh, my God.
Let's not call that shipping.
They put them
it's
in
first,
boxes.
Yeah, it was express shipping, first
get
class.
In this yacht.
So they had this dinner for the Pakistan, for the, I don't know, like it was a, you know, an elite Pakistan government official and his daughter or something. And they came and they had this glamorous dinner and they cooked all the food and had it shipped, you know. And so, you know, they had avocado mimosa and...
An avocado mimosa?
Hold on 1 second. So here we are. So here's the chef that prepares this fabulous dinner. And another interesting thing about this during this particular time in the very early 1960s was they changed the way that post-dinner, Miss Kennedy Onassis, you know, she would allow for times of entertainment and that the men and the women would mingle together instead of going off to their separate rooms as was prior.
Right.
With prior presidency. So this is the beginning of gender equality, perhaps. So you know, interesting. I mean, the beginning.
Oh, because right now it's totally equal.
Yeah, luckily they now started, it's now chill. It's completely
chill. Cool.
And they put shakers with, they built a bar in the state dining room, and you could pour martinis and bourbon. They had all these. So people were...
They classed up the joint. They started shaking loose, right? From what I understand about the Kennedys, they liked to party. They liked to drink. They were young. They were beautiful. They were friends with celebrities, much like the Obamas. And they classed up the joint, much like the Obamas.
Yes, they classed up the joint. So, and anyway, so this all, you know, all these wonderful French things. And the, so after, listen, what happened?
Yeah.
So, as you know, a tragedy struck. Yes. And... you know, Mr. Kennedy was assassinated, yeah. And what went on with the chef, like what happened, I mean, he couldn't work there. He's continued to work at the White House for a little bit.
Okay.
But he obviously left, and at one point, I think it was Lyndon B. Johnson mm-hmm. that took over, and they wanted him to make a chickpea puree, aka hummus, and he refused. He was like, I will not make that garbage chickpeas puree.
I find it so interesting that Lyndon Johnson wanted hummus.
I don't know, apparently, and I guess, well, apparently it was the new chef.
Oh.
And he was giving him canned vegetables because he said they were cheaper, and he, you know.
Cheaper? It's the fucking White House.
Exactly. Ugh. So, all these things, 1960s, sort of just led, the moral of the story is that because of, you know, somebody's, of our political leaders being role models.
Yeah.
That we were taught as Americans to get away from, to shy away from the canned processed right. foods of the 1950s. That was, that they were, you know, these food companies were trying to hawk onto people, mm-hmm. say like, look, TV dinners, it's easy, right. and mom doesn't have to work.
Post-World War II.
And then they tried to bring it back about the enjoyment of life and the beauty of food and,
yeah.
and the sheer pleasure of it. And that's a good thing.
It's a great thing. So
that's a great thing.
I love that. So the big French food kind of pop and revolution in the 1960s, essentially it was yes. was ushered in by the class and style of the Kennedys, and then also
the right timing
by
of,
the art of French cooking.
By the art of French cooking, but also because this woman, Judith Jones,
right.
saw somebody and looked through, you know, she said she looked at the manuscript, which was like an encyclopedia back then. Like, I'm yeah. sorry, you want a cookbook with like yeah, a recipe for a baguette? Recipes. Like, people don't even know. People are still making TV dinners here.
Exactly.
And she said, you know what? Let's give it a chance. And then it all, think about how that just changed the whole food world.
Absolutely. It's the most important cookbook to this day, as far as I'm concerned.
Continues to yeah. change it on a daily basis.
It's my, like, you know, proverbial running out of the house with something's on fire cookbook. Mm-hmm. Like, if I could only have one cookbook for the rest of my life, it would be that. And not even so much because I use it. Like, I don't really cook from many cookbooks, but I love looking through it. That's, like, the most... Mm-hmm. I don't know, the nostalgia of it, right?
Well, some of my favorites, and we can just go off a little bit. Like, some of my favorite cookbooks from the 1960s, obviously that one,
yes.
The Mastering of the Art of French Cooking. The other one is by Vincent Price, The Treasury of Great Recipes, which I've mentioned before.
And yes, that's going to be a whole.
I mean, that could be a Halloween television show
that may or may not come back.
Yes,
in the future.
Just remember
if you're a
that
Vincent
name.
Price fan.
Vincent Price, and. All these things. And then, okay, so now, check this out. Also, during that time, you know, MFK Fisher was a food writer. And mm-hmm. there's a really good book if you find this subject interesting like I do, not just from a culinary perspective, but there's so many other authors that I haven't mentioned and cookbook people and people. I mean, this guy, Richard Olney, was popular in the 1960s.
Yeah.
He was living in France, and he also wrote some fabulous cookbooks also. And they were kind of all living in the late 60s together.
In one
in
house?
Provence. Oh. And there's a book, yeah. I think there's a book called
and then
Provence.
They all put their keys in a basket.
Yeah, they all put their keys in a basket. And that is why... Yeah,
that's how right. Julia Child and Dom DeLuise made a baby.
Yeah, that is where we... That's where Susan Powder came from. You didn't know that. So all these people... There's a book called 1970 Provence by Luc Barr. He's a food historian. So if you're interested in that, that's a good one to check out. And I just love, I mean, I think the food styling in the 1960s,
amazing.
There was just, it was fresh. It was new. It was exciting.
Absolutely. But there was also a lot of cherries on everything.
Yeah. They were doing the best they could. You know, they were limited to the ingredients that
totally.
Were being imported in as, but that, that demand that the
oh yeah
that our shoppers Americans totally. Created that was what helped you know
absolutely
now, some things kind of fell apart in the 70s again in the 80s let's not talk about it
goodbye the 80s
Ronald Reagan
again
like, why don't you just have a can of chicken I don't know cream of celery
exactly so I think it's interesting the food styling of the 1960s in general is really coming back now mm-hmm. that kind of like dim lighting yes. or actually ultra bright
right I think so yeah
it's like dim in my brain but really like when you're lighting it like on a
shadows,
photo shoot yeah
and they have lots of texture in the photos
lots of texture
you know because
yeah.
the film could have been overexposed or anything
yeah.
on purpose and yeah and I think you know Amy Sedaris loves the 60s
oh, yes.
her whole show is basically her new show At Home with Amy Sedaris is kind of a spinoff of the 1960s.
Totally. Well, you know what I'll say about the food scene in the 1960s, and tell me if you agree or disagree. Feel free to push back. Yeah. I think that a lot of my favorite and a lot of America's favorite classic recipes, now I realize a lot of these things, some of these things are not, you know, just American food, but the most classic recipes, in my opinion, stem from the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
right? Like a wedge salad.
Yeah.
A Cobb salad.
Yep, all these things.
A chef salad, a Caesar salad.
Yeah.
No, but you know what I mean.
Chicken and gelatin, classic.
Yeah, chicken and jelly.
Yeah.
No, but like a lot of deviled eggs. A lot of these things are things that became really popular in the 1960s.
Now every bar has to have them on the menus
exactly.
Nowadays.
Nowadays. But you know, the thing that's interesting about this time that we live in, as opposed to the 60s or 50s or before, but I really do think that the 1960s were the time in American food history where we developed most of our classic
yeah,
staying
a lot of
recipes.
It. Yeah, yeah,
the 60s and probably like the 20s. Mm-hmm. But we don't really have new classics that much anymore. Like the foods that, while I think there's wonderful things going on with food today, amazing, great things in the 2000s, interesting, exciting stuff. Very few new classics.
Yeah, new classics. How about that?
I think the one new classic that I can think of, and I don't even know how new classic it is because it hasn't had enough time to fully spread, is the endive salad from Estella. Ignacio Matos' endive salad.
Had it.
It's unbelievable.
Well, how about that?
It's delicious.
I've got to go try it. We have a friend that bartends there.
We do. We're yes. going right now.
And exactly.
Bye. Just kidding.
Okay, we're back.
We're
oh my
done.
God, it was so...
oh, it was so delicious.
The endive
oh,
salad.
I'm so full of endive, I could just die. So listen,
endive.
Breton, I could endive. I could
endive
into a pool of endive.
Do tell me your favorite 1960s recipe besides clams casino.
Okay, so top three.
Yeah, yeah.
This week, we'll each give our top three favorite 1960s foods. Are you smelling the microphone?
I'm thinking about my favorite 1960s
my
foods.
My microphone smells
alive.
Really good. Okay. Number three 1960s food favorite, I guess Lobster Thermidor. Love it. Not really sure when it was created. It could have been created in the 1910s, for all I know, but it was popular on menus during mm-hmm. the 1960s, so take that.
Well, you already said... A wedge salad.
A wedge salad is probably my number one. But before I get to number one, let me do number two. So number three, lobster thermidor. Number two, 1960s food, devils on horseback.
Yes, yes.
Or rumikai.
Rumikai, I don't
or
know
do you
that...
say rumaki or rumikai?
Oh, I think I've said well, rumaki.
Rumaki, okay. So it's a water chestnut inside a chicken liver wrapped in bacon on a toothpick.
Yeah, that was...
That's
okay.
my number two.
Okay.
And then my number three, again, not sure when it was created, don't care. My number one, don't care when it was created, but it was popular during the 1960s
because
we wedge salad
when we weren't alive, so we know best.
Yes,
but that's like the new kids being like, I know the 80s. I'm like, you were born in 95.
Totally.
You know what you're talking about, but we're gonna talk about this.
Yeah,
our 1980s were the 1960s, like for
exactly our nostalgia for the
exactly.
the unremembered 60s.
Okay, so I have a I can't, let me, off the top of my head, I wasn't prepared for this, but I'm really smart, so let's do it. 1, 2, 3, go. Okay, so my third, I'm so smart. We used to have cannibal sandwiches.
What the hell is that?
Cannibal sandwiches were raw beef. And
oh.
It was raw beef with, you would salt and pepper the heck out of it. You would basically put a mound of raw beef. It was a steak tartare without the steak
without
tartare.
Without the fixins.
Without the fixins.
It was
and
a
you would
raw
get those
hamburger.
Pumpernickel slices of bread around it. And you would put big, round slices of onion.
Whoa.
And I love it. I still want to do it at this at an
oh
upcoming.
Oh my God. That
and
sounds so good.
And you just take
so
some
good.
Nice ground, lean, you know, nice raw beef, and you just put it on a sandwich. On a, not even a sandwich, an open face little pumpernickel.
Is that from the 60s or is that
I
just something you
so.
Like?
No, I think that was from the 60s.
It sounds very 60s.
And then Number two, you've already said all of my favorite things.
That's
but
okay.
I guess chicken a la king.
No. Dude, chicken a la king is so delicious.
And I was going to say, I mean, I've already said it, but Clams Casino.
Yeah, you can say Clams Casino.
And really, I thought about Clams Casino because it tends to have sausage, right? Or am I thinking?
No, Clams Casino has bacon.
Bacon. So I'm sorry. Bacon. You could put, that's what I was going to say, maybe instead of bacon, I thought.
Oh, a riff on it with sausage?
Yeah, but you like some like crumbled sausage and then just, it basically is baked clams.
Yeah, baked clams with sausage.
Put some breadcrumbs and, you know, whatever. You can do whatever you want, but, oh, you know, we are still left over from our clam episode talking about that.
We have leftover clams.
No, but I went to Chinatown and I bought this giant clam. Yeah. Like these giant clams. They're like $2 a piece.
How big was it?
Well, it was the size of my fist opened up wide.
Oh, wow.
But it was, I dropped it and cracked it. And Zara, last night I was like, I'm going to cook it anyway. Zara said, why would you risk getting sick from a, so this is the thing, like
literally risking death.
Death because you don't want to waste a $2. Because I felt bad. I felt bad. I ruined a clam's life and then I didn't get to eat it.
It doesn't even really have a brain.
It is a bivalve.
Yeah, it's stupid. It's fine.
But yeah, so
it's basically just a rock.
And then there was something else, and I don't know if this is the 1960s, but I always think of it as a chocolate cake roll.
Oh, yes. A Swiss cake roll.
If that's 50s or 60s, I don't care.
I mean, it definitely wasn't invented in the 60s, but it was very popular in the 60s. Also, I'm going to throw something right out there at you. Fondue.
I forgot to say.
I just threw blazing hot fondue at Brenton's face.
Ow!
I'm going to throw something at you. A pot of fondue.
Dude, jerk.
Catch.
Okay. Everybody that got married in the 60s, my parents got married. No, I think it was 70, but whatever. Close to. They were engaged in the 60s, and everybody got a fondue pot.
I'm looking at one right now that Jenny bought me. It's up there. We got to use that thing.
We got to get some fondue. I have those gorgeous fondue skewers.
Oh, yeah. You got them at yesterday's news.
Yes, I did.
So that brings me to what I think we should talk about today on Chef Recommends.
Oh, what do you recommend?
I think that we should talk about how to throw a perfect 60s cocktail party.
Okay. Well.
I mean, this could be a whole episode in its own.
Exactly.
But let's try to.
But here's a quick.
Give our tips.
Quick pickle thing. Okay. So when I think of. You want to hit all the points, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was not alive during the 60s, so it doesn't matter. So if it's a little bit off, who cares? Just like the kids wearing stonewashed jeans.
Exactly. Like it's the
They're 90s. Wearing 1993 jeans and calling them 1987. I'm like, no.
They don't understand.
You understand. That was eighth grade. This
well,
is sixth
we
grade.
Did have that one cocktail party at my house all those Christmases ago where you brought an accordion, wore a shirt, a sweater with a
from
dickie.
From the 1960s.
Yeah. So let's just start with the outfit.
Okay.
Polyester.
So you're going to want to have some polyester. Right? So make sure you get your air conditioner nice and cool because everybody's going to be sweating bullets.
Pass out deodorant.
Yeah, sweating chicken on bullets. And then pass out deodorant and you're going to get a key jar for everybody's keys.
Key party.
So your big hits for the 60s, I think we said quite a few of them.
Yeah. Deviled eggs.
Deviled eggs.
Rumikai.
Rumikai.
Devils on horseback.
Can you tell us what
other
devils?
Devil things.
Devils on horsebacks.
Devils on horseback are prunes with bacon wrapped around
bacon
them.
Bacon wrapped. Yes. Yeah. I think of those.
Or bacon wrapped dates, rather.
Yeah, the water chestnut thing. Yeah.
Rumikai.
Rumikai.
Yeah.
We didn't put chicken liver in ours.
Yeah, rumikai. Rumikai is chicken liver, always.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, we didn't know.
Devil on horseback is basically like a ramaki, but with. No chicken liver.
With no chicken liver.
Exactly.
And now I can rest in peace, everybody. I know the difference.
A cheese ball.
Okay, you got to have a cheese ball.
A nut-covered cheese ball.
That's you know what? I'm going to give you a quick thing of a cheese ball. You're like, oh my God, what do you mean? Like, what kind of cheese? It doesn't matter.
One single cheese ball. No, just kidding. Like, you know, the like little Cheetos?
Yeah, the little baby cheese ball. Amy Sedaris used to make her own cheese ball and sell them. I think she still does special orders. But basically, you take a bunch of cream cheese. You can take... you can mix cheeses. Take the leftover cheeses. I think they were meant for like, you know, economical. Yeah. Like, oh, I have a little bit of goat cheese and I have a little bit of cheddar. But like, and you can shred it and puree it in the food processor with some cream
cheese.
And then you can add some sherry to it. You could put some, you know, you could add some anything. Bunch of chopped herbs.
Yeah. Well, herbs, definitely. Pop a mustard.
Poppy seeds. Let's name
totally.
It.
Totally.
Why not? Want some
cashews?
Cashews. You got it. Crushed walnuts. Oh, wait. Well, that's on the outside.
Yeah, walnuts are on the outside.
Diced celery.
Absolutely.
Not?
Pickles.
Capers. Stop it.
Olives. Tuna fish.
There's too many options.
Take everything you have in your house. Mix
it
with some
cream
cheese.
Okay, so now what are you going to serve for a cock-a-doodle-doo? What are we going to serve?
Well, classics. And that's the other thing I wanted to say. Classic cocktails. Like, obviously, you know, we know the martini was... developed in not the 60s. We did an episode for some reason. The actual
a lot of
year
the Italian drinks were invented, right, that we drink now.
Totally. But they're all, even if they were invented in the turn of the century, the 60s is what I think when I think classic cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you would go, you know what, I think it had something to do with, you would go to the bars those in the 1960s and they had the placemats that had all the cocktails on them.
Yeah, which is always
Manhattan.
Wonderful. Yep.
If you're going to do a 60s cocktail party, keep classic. I would say do a pitcher of Negroni, pitcher of Manhattan, a pitcher of...
pink squirrels.
Yeah. Classic.
I always think of a pink squirrel. And I remember going through my grandparents' 1960s bar books when I was like Mr. Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
Bartender book. You know, dated 1965, and I would read it, and I'd always remember turning to the page that said a pink squirrel, and I didn't know what it was, but I know that I want that drink.
It just sounds like a penis.
Oh, is that what it means?
I don't know.
Oh, my God, my childhood
memories.
Doesn't
it sound like it, though?
Hey, Grandpa.
Hey, Gladys, you want to come over here and have a pink squirrel?
Yeah. Hey, I have a little pegs in a blanket.
I made it stiff.
Yeah, yeah. Ba-dum-bum.
Ding, 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 ding. But what is a pink squirrel?
I don't know.
Damn it.
Hold on 1 second.
Okay.
Okay, so a pink squirrel, here's the very simple, but it's a lot of sugar and heavy cream. It's creme de noyau, which is like a nut, you know, it's a...
Right.
I don't know, it's like a schnapps, a nut schnapps.
Ooh, nuts.
And then 1 ounce creme de cacao and heavy cream, and you shake.
Is it even pink?
Well, I think the creme de noyau, and then you put a cherry in it, one of those like nice things.
Okay, that sounds
some
like
some people
you could...
say put some ruby red creme de noyau. I don't know. Let's just change the recipe and call it a pink squirrel.
Okay, perfect. So, yeah, I would do, like, so we're having a nice 1960s cocktail party spread. You invite your friends over. Ask everybody to dress up. Fun. You put out a cheese ball, some deviled eggs.
Get the fondue pot roaring.
Yeah. Oh, yes, of course. The fondue pot. Pitcher of martinis with, like, olives and onions and cute squirrels. I have fucking squirrels on the brain now. Oh, my God. There's a squirrel right there. Some cute skewers.
And now what you're going to want to do is go to the antique store and get some of those antique ashtrays that are big enough for 4,000 cigarette butts. So that and 40 people can use the same ashtray together.
Exactly. Yes. Perfect. So allow smoking in the house.
Allow smoking in the house. Turn off all cell phones.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
And don't Instagram it.
Don't
be like,
oh,
this is so cute. Just leave it alone. Pretend like you're actually in the 60s.
And then get a bunch of, ditch weed. Ditchweed is what we call very cheap marijuana.
Oh, we used to call it regs.
Yeah, regs. That's what the new kids call it. I just found this out.
Regweed.
This girl's like, reg. And I was like, ditchweed? She's like, no, reg. Like,
regs.
It's supposed to, does that mean regular?
Yeah.
Excuse me, miss. So does that mean regular?
Yes. When I was in high school, anyone who was lame, like instead of being, you're lame, we'd call them a reg lover.
Well, damn, that was the weed we were smoking. And,
yeah. Oh, I smoked it too.
I like it.
I wish I could still get regs.
You don't get high.
It's perfect for me. Regular weed makes me very scared.
So,
but anyway, yeah, get a bunch of regs.
It just makes you hungry, which is great because you have a cheese ball. And then I'm going to finish off that. We're going to finish off that party and you are going to get that cannibal sandwich.
Ooh, yum.
And you're going to get you're going to go to your butcher and you're going to say, hey, Mr. Butcher, Mrs. Butcher nowadays in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Ms. Butcher or just Butcher.
Yeah, just plain Butcher.
Just plain old Butcher. Butcher, could you fresh grind me? I would like some sirloin. And what else would you put in some like a nice raw beef tartare?
I mean,
you could do like top brown or sirloin. You could put, I mean, if you wanted.
It's a dry age.
If you want to have filet because you have lots of money to spend on that, go ahead.
Yeah.
Unnecessary.
I think sirloin is just... perfect.
Just perfect. Yeah. And you're going to spread that on those little pumpernickel toasts.
Oh, my
God.
You're
going to get in marble rye, if preferable, and then slice some onions.
That sounds great.
Salt, tons of salt and pepper.
We need to throw another cocktail, 60s cocktail party.
We should do it together. Maybe that's what we should do for a pop-up.
Oh, my God.
That would actually be fun.
Guys, we are just expanding. Every time we get together these days, we're just thinking of something new.
We both traveled, and this is what it comes down to.
I didn't travel yet, but...
You're going to. In my head, you already did, and you already came back. Don't rush it.
You've already gone. I'm like, oh my God, I missed it.
If
I don't even remember going.
If we're lucky for next week, maybe you'll be lucky, and I might pop over to Rome, and we'll do a live...
Oh my God.
Life's a Banquet in Rome.
Please, that'd be so fun.
We'll see. Yeah.
Also, we have more fun surprises coming at you. Brett and I have a new project we're working on. and we love you guys. And this was a fun episode. This is like my favorite topic.
Yes, we could go ramble on and on because it's so fun. And oh yeah, music. You're gonna put pop organ varieties. You're gonna
60s French pop radio station on Spotify is great.
You know, yeah, Bridget Bardot radio, very good.
Amazing. Yeah,
there is just it's the thing about the '60s is people were having fun.
They were having a blast. They were fucking. They were drinking.
And that's the thing, too. There was also not everybody, as we exemplified in this episode, that there were people that were actually dying going to war. So the people that were staying here are like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I mean, what can you do? Besides, once you've...
That's a good point.
You know, once you've volunteered and, you know, made yourself political and voted and just done all the things that a regular citizen can do, you know, besides working your regular job and being tired and, you know, feeding your pets and, and your lovers and... At the end of the day, I'd be like, they just were like, let's just live.
Yeah,
let's
they wanted
put on
to just
this
live.
Polyester. I want pops of color. I want avocado green refrigerators.
Totally. And the color schemes were fabulous.
Yes.
Then it's interesting because, you know, right now we're in a time, you know, we're recording this 2 days or 1 day after Brett Kavanaugh has been voted as the next Supreme Court justice. Mm-hmm. And everyone's feeling emotional. Well, I shouldn't say everyone.
Yeah.
50% of the country isn't feeling emotional.
50% of the population is very happy.
But 50% of the population, including Brett and I, are feeling pretty upset and just heartbroken over what's happening. And it's kind of, I posted something on Instagram yesterday about Auntie Mame and how Auntie Mame, you know, the patron saint of this podcast, if you guys haven't seen the movie, watch it.
Exactly.
She's amazing. But, you know, she taught us to live and try to have fun and drink and dance and be with people that you love and celebrate life whenever possible.
Whenever possible.
Especially when times are shitty.
When times are shitty, then my theory is it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right? Like, oh, I'm... And the thing with, you know, I went through a very difficult financial year and you know what? We had great parties.
Absolutely.
Somehow it didn't matter that somehow also I had...
You were more fabulous.
Yet somehow I always had oysters and caviar. Yeah. I don't know. Somebody would be like, oh, I have an extra bag of oysters.
You just ask the universe for what you need and it's oysters.
Exactly.
And caviar. But, you know, let's all just, you know, if you're like-minded, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably on the same tip as we are. So, you know, we'll band together. We'll be there for each other. We'll drink. We'll dance. We'll laugh and love and bang and... and bong.
Bang. And
bing, bang, boom,
water bong.
But have fun and try to live life and enjoy and just get through the time, but also fight.
Yeah.
And stand up. But
exactly.
Then at the end of the day, when you're done protesting, sit down and sip a martini and laugh with your friends.
Because you will be hungry.
You deserve to have fun.
Now, if you have any questions all about anything that we said, again, we love hearing your emails.
We do.
Life'sabanquetshow@gmail.com. Again, the easiest way is on Instagram, Life's a Banquet Podcast. You can direct message us. We'll both check it and we both respond.
Yep. Grindr, Tinder, nuts.com, pets,
Facebook, everything. But, you know, if we see you in the street, give us a wink, give us a nudge.
Yeah.
And
please.
What?
Give us a wink and a nudge.
So thank you very much, Thar. Have a wonderful time in Rome.
Thanks.
I can't wait to hear about all your adventures.
I can't wait for you to come and pop up and visit. It would be really fun.
Spain, who? I'm in Italy now.
Jet Setter International.
Yeah.
Hasta la pasta, babes.
All right. Ciao till next time.
Bye. All of our episodes are recorded right here at Studio 54 at the heart of Fort Greene, Brooklyn. Our rock star award-winning sound editor and producer is Christine Farrell. I'm Zara Tangora.
And I'm Bretton Scott. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening.